Hello and a very good Saturday morning to you. You're very welcome along to the weekend edition here on Highland Radio with me, Greg Hughes. Hope you are well. Coming up on the programme, we talk about the Irishman who captained Manchester United and managed Barcelona. Do you know him? Ian Miller discusses his viral footage of how he climbed the Knocknamara sea stack in Donegal. A professor says gossiping is good for you. Well, he'll join us on the show to explain his research. We talk motors with journalist Geraldine Herbert, and Peter Dodkin has details of Airbnb and how you could make money from your spare room, but the problems that could ensue. The truly inspirational Desi Fitzgerald, who was paralysed in a freak hurling accident, tells us his amazing story. And there are two live musical performances. Imogen's Story takes on an Elton John classic, while Letterkenny's Joel Harkin gives us a sample of his unique style. Okay, that's just the tip of the iceberg. We also want your calls, comments and requests, as always, to the programme. You can call Yvonne right now on 07491 25000. You can text us directly, 086 77 00 555. If you wish to tweet me, it's at Greg Hughes 2. And we're also on Facebook, /Highland Hub, where you'll get all details of what we're talking about throughout the course of this morning. As I say, hope you're very well. A little bit cloudy out this morning, but apparently it's going to clear up as the afternoon progresses. But then come evening time, the rain will move across the west, as it seems to be the norm. But we're looking forward to a mini heat wave next week. Apparently, by Wednesday, we're looking at temperatures of 28, 29 degrees, which sounds absolutely delightful. Right, before we move on to our first item in the programme, a quick look at the front of the newspapers and what will be greeting you if you pick up your copy today. And as always, our newspapers come to us thanks to Kelly's Centra at the Mountaintop in Letterkenny. And it's a horrible scene on the front of most of the papers. Massacre at the Beach is the front of the Irish Daily Mirror. 38 people have been killed, massacred, gunned down in the Tunisian massacre, as it's being called. Lorna Carty, an Irish woman, was amongst those. She was killed in the resort of Suez on a day of global terror with attacks in France and Kuwait. And the death toll there, absolutely huge. And at the same time, incidences in France and further afield as well. That's the front of the Irish Daily Star. Also, Irish mum among the dead. Just absolutely terrible scenes. So we'll go to the back of the Irish Sun. They're focusing on the big game tonight, at least big from our perspective, whether you're from Derry or Donegal, because it is the clash of the two in the Ulster Senior Football Championship. They're chatting to Eamon McGee. He insists Derry's boss, Brian McIver, is the man who kick-started his career. As I mentioned, McGee's Donegal faced Derry in the Ulster SFC semi-final tonight. McIver managed Donegal, of course, for 2 years. 2006, wasn't it? 2008. And McGee has held his impact. The hardy defender said, "I remember saying to him, sorry for effing up again, but he kept with me." And I suppose when you are a player and your confidence is a bit down, that's the kind of support you need from a manager. The Irish Independent, more of the awful tragedy in Tunisia, the massacre in Tunisia, slaughtered on the beach is their headline there. And that's the, excuse me, that's a similar headline in the Irish Daily Mail there as well. On to the Irish Times Weekend Edition. Irish woman among 38 killed in gun attack in Tunisia. Digicel's US flotation to raise hundreds of millions is another story featuring businessman Dennis O'Brien. Apparently, he's to float his mobile phone business Digicel on the New York Stock Exchange in 3 to 4 months' time, raising hundreds of millions of dollars. Digicel lodged a form with the US financial regulator, the Securities and Exchange Commission, yesterday for formally announcing its intention to offer shares in the company for sale on the New York market. Okay, that's as serious as we're going to get this Saturday morning. We're joined by our first guest on the programme now, Richard Fitzpatrick, who is an author, and he is going to discuss his latest book with us. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Greg. How are you?
Very good. Lovely to chat with you.
Great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Now, Patrick McConnell is a name I hadn't come across before. He's the subject of your new book, and by all accounts, a very, very interesting man.
He was an extraordinary character. Yeah, he was born in Dublin in 1887 and had glittering professional football career across in England, playing with Sheffield Wednesday, Hull City and Manchester United before and during the First World War. And then he really made a name for himself as one of the first wave of managers from British football who took over management of clubs in Spain. He was manager of several clubs, first Racing Santander in 1922, and he went on to manage Real Oviedo and Real Betis, who he led to their sole La Liga title in 1935. It was an extraordinary achievement. At the time, the club were only getting gates of 1,500 people, so for them to get one over the likes of Real Madrid and Barcelona was an extraordinary achievement. And that summer in 1935, Barca came calling, and he went on to manage Barcelona during the Spanish Civil War, and then several more clubs in the 40s, predominantly down in Seville, Sevilla, and Real Betis again.
As so, you mentioned, foreign managers, in inverted commas, coming over to Britain and Ireland managing, and vice versa, is not unusual now, but he must have been one of the first.
He was. There was another guy. He took over from a guy called Fred Pentland at Racing Santander. Fred Pentland was one of the great pioneers of football, a kind of Pep Guardiola of his time. He was very innovative in his thinking, as was O'Connell. He was, when he got to manage Barca during the Spanish Civil War, he was known for his emphasis on fitness. And he also didn't brook any discontent from the directors upstairs. He was like, he famously one time wouldn't play a star Spanish goalkeeper that the president of his club had bought. He preferred the incumbent guy. So he was he knew his own mind, and he'd great success.
And is he hailed as a hero in parts of Spain still? Because, as you mentioned, I missed the name of the club, but to bring them to title success, especially against the opposition you talked of, I presume his name is something to be conjured with over there still.
It is. You hit the nail on the head. He's known as Don Patricio down in Seville. They just celebrated the 80th anniversary of that La Liga title, which grows in luster the more the years go on. They could never win a league title again. Like, they're just too far behind the other clubs at this stage. So it's he's revered there, and it's fascinating. He's far better known in Spain than he would be in Britain, where he played his professional football, or Ireland, where he grew up, and he spent a season with Belfast Celtic as well. He lies in an unmarked grave in London. At the moment, he died in as a pauper in London. It was a very sad end to his career. And of course, the really interesting aspect to his life was his private life. He was a bigamist, and that's where I've done a lot of my research. He had two wives. They were both Irish, both named Ellen, and curiously, both looked alike.
Were they aware of each other?
They weren't. This is the thing. Right. He abandoned his first family and four kids in 1922. And so he left them behind in Manchester, and they got the odd letter with a few pesetas in it over the years. So they knew he was in Spain, but that was it. He had a go-between. His brother lived in London, and he was kept informed about how the family were getting on in Manchester, which was very badly. The first wife had to work as a cleaning lady. They lived in poverty up in Manchester, and then so he made his life in Spain, and he met this second wife, Ellen her maiden name was Ellen O'Callaghan. Uh-huh. And he met her during the Spanish Civil War. She was working as a governess for well-to-do families in Spain, so he met her in Barcelona just before the Spanish Civil War, and they got married, but she didn't know anything about the first wife and family. She was a devout Catholic. She would have been appalled.
Of course,
you can imagine, especially in those times.
And you talked about him dying a pauper. What led to his demise?
Yeah, this the drama. His last management gig was in 49, and so I mean there wasn't pundit jobs back in those days for retired football managers. So he wouldn't have had much income. He'd worked freelance effectively all his career and just living by the day. And the second wife, Ellen O'Callaghan, was, you know, she saved her money and later went on to buy a house back in Middleton in Cork when their marriage broke up. But so she what happened, according to the O'Callaghan family, is that the son of his first marriage tracked him down in Seville in the 1950s, and he wanted to meet him. You know, he hadn't seen him in 30 years. He was always curious about it. So they met in a park every day in Seville, and he had to pretend that he was a nephew. Nobody in Spain knew about this, that he had another wife and family. So, but the meeting didn't go well. The first thing O'Connell said to him when he met his son after more than 30 years was, "How are Man United getting on?" And he asked nothing about the brothers and his sister, you know, his own children. So it seems that Ellen, number two, the second wife, found out about the family as a result of this reunion, and she broke off all ties with him. So he drifted back to London, and he lived in an attic room in his brother's house and died, as I say, a pauper. He only left £5.
And pretty lonely too, by the sounds of things.
Exactly, yeah.
And what drew you to... I mean, look, it's clear Patrick McConnell is an amazing story, but what raised the flags with you to say, right, I'm going to research this and write a book on this man?
I had read it. I moved to Spain. I live in Barcelona. I moved here in 2010, and I had read about him in a book on the history of Barca just a couple of months after arriving here. But what really triggered the interest was that summer in 2010, about a week after Spain had won the World Cup, I listened to a program on RT Radio from John Bowman's archives, and he had an interview, a radio interview with Dan Treston, the estranged son of Paddy O'Connell, from 1991. And this is amazing. His son went on to become a famous radio producer and director. He won a Pre-Italia Award. And that's, but he spoke about, you know, what had become of the family. So that piqued my interest. And at the time, I was writing a book on the history of El Clásico.
Now, you've got two... I beg your pardon, sorry, but you've got two markets. You could potentially have two markets, because this could be glorifying his career and what he achieved, and the book would be hugely successful, I'm sure, not least in Spain, maybe, and further afield. Or you could do a warts and all type of book whereby, you know, it's a different, almost like a different market. What way are you going with this in your piece of work?
My interest mainly is the worth and all his the private life, the double life he led is amazing. I mean, you just couldn't get away with it today, not in the Western world anyway, because of Google and Facebook and stuff. It would be so easy to find out about.
And the law.
I mean, exactly. Bigamy at the time, even in Spain, you know, they used to brand bigamists on the face in medieval times. So there was a huge stigma at the time, and still today with the bigness.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the extraordinary aspect of his story, and several incidents during his football career as well. He was involved in the biggest match fixing scandal in British football.
Okay.
as captain of Manchester United in 1915 in a match against Liverpool. So there are extraordinary elements.
And what, did they throw the game, or what's the allegation there?
Yeah. Oh, no, it's well proven.
Right, so I'm covered.
it's they're all dead anyway, so we don't have to worry about libel. But it was 1915, and the old English First Division it looked inevitable that it would be suspended because the war was dragging on. And Liverpool was set to play Man United on Good Friday, that's spring of 1915. So the players, knowing that their income was about to come to an end,
they decided to fix the game. They met in a pub in Manchester on Monday before the match and arranged to fix it at a 2-0 scoreline. And then they placed bets all over the country at 7 and 8 to 1. And sure enough, when the match was played a few days later on that Good Friday, and they just went through the motions. There was about 15,000 people at Old Trafford to watch it. And the fans were disgusted at the carry-on. They were shouting, play up, you rotters, all this kind of stuff. And
how very 1915.
Was,
play up, you rotters!
So the manager of Man United, apparently, this what they say is that he walked out before the full-time whistle. He was so disgusted as well.
Of course, they let him down. So how far away from the book being on the market are we?
Well, I've just finished a documentary on it, so that's just the first step of my inquiry. I interviewed Sue O'Connell. Mm-hmm. She's married to the grandson of of Paddy O'Connell, his name is Mike O'Connell. So I interviewed both of them for the documentary, and Sue has written a manuscript for a book. She's been researching him for 18 years. So we're hoping that she'll get a publisher. She's trying to get a publisher at the moment.
Mm.
So we'll see what happens.
Superb. Okay, and that documentary hasn't aired yet either, no?
It has. It's just gone out. It's on. It's available on the RT website.
Oh, that's T.G. Cahir, because someone's just texted in saying there's a great documentary on T.G. Cahir about Patrick O'Connell if you get a chance to watch it. So that's your work, is it?
No, that's produced by Grainne McIlwain. A great story.
All right, well, I'm going to check out both of them. That's my Saturday afternoon coverage anyway. Listen, yeah. Patrick, it's been an absolute... Not Patrick. That'd be some trick. Richard, it's been a fantastic chatting to you. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
And we look forward to seeing it. And where you're in Spain at the moment?
I'm in Barcelona.
Tell us what the weather's like briefly, just to make me feel bad.
Blue skies.
Knock it out. All right, then. God bless you. Take care, Richard. That's Richard Fitzpatrick there. He's an author who's been researching Patrick O'Connell's McConnell's life. It's very interesting, isn't it? Seems like some character. You're very welcome back to the programme. I'm joined in studio by Ian Miller. A very good morning to you, Ian.
Good morning, Rick.
How are you?
Oh, fine, man.
Very good, very good. You are with Unique Ascent.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
What I do is I take people rock climbing, in essence, take them to places that are quite far removed from the normal world. And I've got a lot of business coming from... mainly abroad, mainly from the States and Canada.
And this is for people, giving them the opportunity to rock climb here in County Donegal.
That's it, yeah.
I've only lately started exploring my own county, believe it or not, and it's astonishing what is there. You don't even have to look for it, but you know, what we don't appreciate, perhaps, even though it's on our own doorstep. I know it's a bit of a cliche at that stage, but so true here, isn't it?
Well, when I started Unique Ascent, I didn't target the national market. I went international. So what I'm doing is promoting Donegal as a rock climbing venue.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to do, actually. I just have to keep going out climbing, making YouTube videos, writing magazine articles, and people are coming in their droves. It's quite amazing, actually.
Because for people, rock climbing enthusiasts or adventure sports enthusiasts, I mean, you couldn't design what we have.
No, it's actually purpose built. It's most of the people that come to me, though, are not climbers per se. They just see they want to do something adventurous. And the byproduct is that, adventurous people are coming.
So how do you do it, say, for instance, how do you give people the experience if they don't necessarily have... experience in rock climbing, and as you say, that seems to be at least a large portion of the people that you're working with.
You give minimal instruction, and you try and keep the day flowing. So I make an objective and I make a plan based on a few emails and then 5 minutes meeting them as to what we're going to do, and it works. It's people watching rather than anything else.
And then you can judge the level of probably their capability.
And usually one sentence in an email gives the game away.
We're linking the video to your climb of Knocknamara Sea Stack.
Yeah.
Tell us about the Sea Stack and what it's like to climb and the experience of it.
Knocknamara is pretty much the best sea stack rock climb on Earth. It's 152 metres long. The stack's 100 metres high. It's 24 kilometres from the nearest main road, which is Ardra, and it's at the base of almost a 1,000-foot cliff. It's almost 500 metres out from land, and you're on a pinpoint summit. It's pretty good.
I'd say when you get to the top of it, you know you've achieved something.
It's emotional.
Yeah. And is that the star attraction for you when you're bringing, you know, particularly maybe a more experienced climber coming over from outside the country over to us? I mean, that's the leave them with the jaw open experience, is it?
Well, what I've got is there's 100 sea stacks in the coast of Donegal, and I've categorised them in my head as to how good they are as an experience. So the world-class sea stacks, there's 6 of them, and thankfully they're scattered from the west coast of Inishowen, Torrey Island, down to southwest Donegal at Port there. So no matter what the weather's doing, the rain's doing, I can follow the sunshine and always get something good done. Yeah, but
do you get much support? I mean, in terms of your business, say, via the likes of the tourist boards or the government or what have you, because, you know, you're out there on your own, effectively, bringing people into the country to experience this. And I'd say a lot of then your trade ends up being word of mouth, you know, once it gets out. Do you happen to do this on your own, or are you getting some help?
No, I work very closely with Welch Ireland.
Brilliant. Excellent.
Very, very closely.
Good.
Yeah. They send me people and I do stuff for them, so it works really well.
Yeah. And we're doing the correct thing in promoting our natural amenities, our natural resources. Don't get me wrong, there's fantastic nightlife and all this type of thing, but in terms of walking, rock climbing, adventure sports, kayaking, I mean, we have it all here, don't we?
Yeah, we're promoting as much as we can, but it takes a while. It's all very well for someone who knows the area to say, this is a great place. But what it takes is for people to come from different countries, experience it, go home. And that's what Falchia Ireland, that's what they're doing at the moment, is they're taking people.
And our particular challenge here is, because we're speaking to some extent in the context of the fact it's going to be or could be a record year for tourism, with numbers growing 12% in the first 5 months of the year. This is according to the CSO. That's fantastic. They're coming into the country, but we have to make sure that we're getting our fair share of those up to the northwest.
Yeah, it's actually, as far as adventure tourism, recreational tourism, it's actually quite easy.
Yeah.
Well,
I think we are guilty sometimes up here of focusing on the negative. We're this far away from there, we're this, that and the other. But rather than the positives and saying, look, this is what we have and let's come up with a solution rather than moaning about the problems.
The distance, if you like, from Dublin's quite easy. I send out emails to people when they're flying in and put connection flights to get them to fly into Dublin, to Donegal Airport. And that saves any aggravation because they arrive in the county, it's part of their flight. They've flown from wherever in the world and they're here already. Yeah.
To us, that seems like a big mountain to climb, but if you live in the likes of America or wherever, you're hopping on planes left, right and centre anyway.
Yeah, they fly to different locations
like
different
buses,
states. Yeah,
and what have you. What about the amount of people locally that are using your services? Is that on the increase? Or I know you're focused on the international market at the moment, but as I said earlier, you know, there's probably a lot of people listening who would love a go at this.
Yeah, I do a lot of local stuff. It's not so much the top end adventurous stuff yet, but that will come. I do focus an awful lot on the training of people, so I've got a little army of people at the moment that are training to be me, which is kind of unusual. But
feels strange.
But it's working, because give it 5 years and tourism is going to be the biggest employer in the country. There's no doubt about it. Everything's pointing towards that way, and it just needs more people to actually provide the stuff that we
that's it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, listen, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. If people want more information, can they search Unique Ascent and get it?
Yeah, absolutely. Rock climbing in Donegal, Unique Ascent. It's quite easy to find.
Excellent. And there is some absolutely amazing videos that you have pulled together, and we're linking at least one of those. I think we're going to go with the Knocknamara Sea Stack video that we're linking on our Facebook page. But it's been a pleasure speaking to you, Ian.
Yeah.
All right, God bless you. Back in a couple of minutes. Imogen Storey from Blackburn. Imogen, a very good morning to you.
Hi, Greg.
How are you?
I'm really good. I'm great.
Excellent. You're leaving us tomorrow. How long have you been here for?
Only since Monday. It's just a short visit.
A flying visit. And tell us a little bit about yourself. Your family connections are here in Donegal, or you have some, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. My auntie and my cousins, they live in Maville on the main street, and my mum's half Irish.
Which half?
The O'Kanes from Lekamy and Mobile. Yeah,
excellent.
Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah. I think so. Well, now you've got me questioning myself.
Sorry.
Well, we'll go with Lekamy. I don't know.
Yeah. Sounds funny.
Lekamy, I think it is. But anyway, and do you come over and back quite regularly to visit the family? Or?
Yeah, a couple of times a year.
Okay, and currently you are studying music, aren't you, in
Blackburn?
Yeah,
popular music performance at the RNC, well, Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester.
And how's that going for you?
I really, really like it. Yeah, I've just finished my first year, so hopefully I've got some good grades. In a couple of weeks, I'll be coming out.
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
It's a tough time of the year, isn't it, because you don't know.
Yeah.
You've done all the spade work, but you're just waiting to see if
yeah, in limbo at the moment.
Are you a gigging musician, or do you perform a lot?
Yeah, we do. I do a lot of performance now that I'm at university, like with people at uni.
Of course.
But I do gigs with my mum, and I do some gigs with a man named Phil Knight as part of the Phil Knight Experience. And then I've got a lot of original music with a band called Raven Traitor. So.
Brilliant. So you've got your finger on the Phil Knight Experience. What is that? Is that a tribute, or
no? It's like. Like, mum's holding the sheet of paper
up,
like,
as if
I don't know.
She said she was nervous.
She's got written here, you go to the RNCM, you sing with Phil Knight. It's like,
have I written your name for you?
Yeah. Just in case I forget. No, yeah, it's just, that's like old, good old Lancashire tunes, and
right.
Are we from Lancashire back home? And
yeah.
Like Irish folk songs and stuff like that.
We sing stuff in Lancashire accents.
Yeah.
Like what?
Well, we try.
Be cold and come on in, there's Lancashire folk in here.
Oh.
Kettles on, so sit thee down and have a cup of cheer.
Yeah.
And people go and watch that, yeah?
Oh, yes.
Don't sound
I'm
so
joking.
Shocked.
I'm joking. It sounds lovely, but an hour of it, do you, Eden?
Oh, no.
I'm only joking.
Maybe that's why no one comes.
I'm sure they do. I'm sure. What do you prefer? Because you're not obviously pretentious about music, so you know you've got your own stuff, but you're still prepared and happy to do covers, and then you know the more traditional stuff with Phil Knight. What's your preference?
I like doing a bit of everything. We do like a bit of everything. I literally do. I've got my finger in a lot of pies.
Okay, and what's your hopes for the future?
Well, hopefully, just to keep singing. Just keep performing.
Would you be the type that wants to do it a certain way, or would you be applying for X Factor, or?
I don't think so. I'm gonna try and do it myself.
Yeah, because that's a crash and burn kind of thing. It's perfectly fine, you know. You get the high for, you know, if you're really successful for a short period of time. But if you think about it, there's so few acts with longevity that have come out of those programs, really.
Yeah. Plus, it's really fixed, isn't it? Like, I don't know. You get people who have. Not bad singers, but you know what I mean? They go through to the finals just to be made a mickey.
That's it.
I mean,
there's seven or eight auditions before you even
get
on the TV.
Yeah, exactly. So they know that they're putting these people.
And you're putting people through for comedic effect, aren't you? Which
I
don't really think it's very fair. But anyway, I like the show. Well, I used to like it. I don't like it as much anymore. But anyway, that's besides the point. You're going to be singing for us very shortly.
Yeah.
Before you do, because you're doing a cover of Elton John's Your Song, which, as I was saying off air, it's one of my favourite songs. I can't wait to hear that. What's your own style, though, with the music that you play with the band that you write yourself?
The music that I write, it's more just like acoustic-y, jazzy type stuff. I like just kind of slow ballady stuff I've been writing at the moment without meaning to. Like, I'm trying to write happy music and it always ends up coming out really sad and soulful.
Well, I was talking to a...
just can't write happy stuff.
A fantastic girl on with us a couple of weeks ago from Strabane, and she's like that, but she accompanies it with a ukulele.
Everything sounds lovely and happy.
Exactly. So she can write her deep, meaningful stuff, but she's there with the ukulele going, and it just takes on a completely different sound.
Maybe that's what I need to do, then start getting back into the ukulele.
Exactly, yeah. So do you play instruments yourself, or...? Yeah.
Well, I mainly sing, but I She's here again with this sheet of paper.
Mum, would you put your sheet of paper away?
Put your paper down.
Thanks.
Because she said she was nervous.
Can you imagine how, if you are nervous when you're trying to speak freely and Mum's there pointing a joined up writing and just... But go on, tell me, what...
Well, I play clarinet. I've played clarinet since I was about 8 or 9. And then I've just started playing more of the saxophone so that I can start a company. Like, there's instrumentals in the middle of songs. I can do that. And then I do a little bit of flute and a bit of ukulele and a bit of guitar. So it's like I do a little bit of a bit of drums. And my mum bought me a didgeridoo once, but... So I've basically every year
she doesn't do the didgeridoo.
I think you might stick that on eBay.
Yeah.
I don't think your future is on the end of a didgeridoo.
No, yeah.
And do you use social media? Do you use YouTube? Do you have a YouTube channel? Or
yeah, I've got a YouTube. If you just type Imogen Story into YouTube, like my original songs come up.
Brilliant.
And then some covers with my mum. And then if you go on Facebook and put Imogen and Melanie Music, our page comes up. We've just made that a couple of months ago.
Brilliant. Because that's a great way of getting your... Melanie, we've given you a bit of a hard time, but obviously you're...
I'm used to it.
Are you? I know you're Imogen's inspiration. It's nice that you can perform together.
Yeah.
It's absolutely a lovely thing to do.
Yeah.
Because Imogen means so much to me and Bill, and she's a wonderful person. And
she's going to cry. She's going to cry.
Oh no, I'd only cry if we've been asked to sing that one that always makes me cry.
Oh, do you know Jason Mraz? I Won't Give Up.
Yes.
All you have to do is play the first couple of chords and she bursts into tears because I sung it once and she enjoyed it.
The waterworks start.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's pride, isn't it?
It's everything. It's just lovely, you know.
So I'm going to play an ad to give you a chance to make your way into the studio next door. Why did you pick your song from Elton John?
It's because that your producer saw it and she liked it and she wanted us to play it here. And she's also asked for At Last as well.
We do it well together, don't we? She asked if she wants to do two if you want. She's got us two.
Just for the record, these are the kind of conversations you have off air.
Ah, right.
Okay. Right. Not that we discuss it now. We're all very relaxed and everything, but we'll definitely get your song in and we'll see what we offer to how we're getting on full time. You said also before we started speaking on air that you might be back in August. Do you have hopes, Imogen, of maybe doing some gigs here or...
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd really enjoy that. I think maybe...
Well, your auntie said about doing a gig at St Eugene's Hall in Moville.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be great because, you know, there's some fantastic venues and the pubs and clubs and halls here are fantastic supporters of new music. Do you know what I mean? Because it can be hard to get a break and get a gig unless you're, you know... Hugely, you know what I'm saying. Okay, well, listen, I'm going to play an ad break while you go next door. Mom, you're going to be playing going to be playing the keyboard, is it?
That's right.
And you're on the vocals.
I am, yeah.
And what's the fella's name again?
Bill?
Is he doing anything? Is he on the spoons?
Daddy is Daddy.
Really? We're calling him Daddy on the radio?
Yeah, great.
There's nothing wrong with you. This would be private.
Dad.
And if you start any of that Lancashire singing in there, I'm cutting you off, all right? All right, then. This is Imogen Story, all the way from Blackburn. And she's performing, accompanied by her mum, Melanie. And this is Elton John's Your Song.
Feeling inside, I'm not one of those who can easily hide. I don't have much money, but boy, if I did, I'd buy a big house where we both could live. If I was a sculptor. But then again, no, or a man who makes potions in a traveling show. No, it's not much, but it's the best I can do. My gift is my song, and this one's for you. And you can tell everybody got me quite cross, but the sun's been quite kind while I wrote down this song. It's for people like you that keep it turned on. So excuse me for getting, but these things I do. You see, I've forgotten if they're green or they're blue. Anyway, the thing is, what I really mean, yours are the sweetest eyes I've ever seen.
Absolutely brilliant, Imogen.
Oh, thank you.